Okay. So we're going to pick up where we left off. Last week we were talking about meiosis, and in particular we were focusing on meiosis one. Meiosis one is where all the interesting stuff happens with respect to producing 1N cells when we begin with 2N or diploid cells. Excuse me, and when we left, we were in prophase of meiosis one, and that was, we see tetrad formation, and tetrad formation continues into metaphase. Remember, meta means middle. The chromosomes are roughly aligned along the center axis of the cell at this point, and then prophase and metaphase of meiosis one, what's happening is homologous chromosomes are lining up right beside each other. And so you've got a maternal and a paternal chromosome. That's what we mean by homologous chromosomes. And they're exchanging DNA from the chromosome. They're undergoing an event called recombination or crossing over, in which segments of each chromosome, each of the homologs, will be exchanged with those of the other. And so, we were talking about part of the chromosome 1 that you got from your dad will exchange with the same part of chromosome 1 that you got from your mother. Normally, when this event takes place, you're exchanging equal amounts of DNA from the same parts of the chromosome. It's usually what we refer to as a reciprocal or an even event, where the same amount moves from each chromosome. Later, when we start talking about problems that occur with chromosomes, we'll talk about what happens when one of the chromosomes loses a bigger piece than it gets back. And that's generally not a good thing, but it happens. And so that's one of the ways in which variation occurs. We talked about the different lifestyles between prokaryotes and eukaryotes. And eukaryotes tend to invest a lot more energy in staying alive longer, raising their offspring. And one of the reasons for that is eukaryotes buy into the idea of genetic variation being a good thing. Okay? That if you have offsprings, you don't want a billion offsprings that look just like you. That tends to be the eukaryotic view of the world, that it's such an investment to get your offspring to maturity. If they're exactly identical, if they're in an environment in which one's not going to do well, none of them will do well. So it's kind of a risky bet. It's like going to the casino and putting all of your chips on black at the roulette table. And eukaryotes have spent so much energy, they don't want to do that. They want to hedge their bet. They want to put a lot on a lot of different bets and hope that one of these things is going to work out. And so the idea of offspring that exhibit genetic variation is very important in the eukaryotic world. And sexual reproduction is a mechanism by which you dramatically increase how much variation you can have in the offspring. And this process of separating the chromosomes into an egg and a sperm, in the case of humans, that increases the amount of variation that you can have. But this event of crossing over or recombination that takes place in prophase and metaphase of meiosis one, it's another mechanism by which you dramatically increase the genetic variation of the offspring produced. Okay. So then metaphase, they're still lined up along the midphase. And again, this doesn't happen in mitosis. The homologs don't pair up during mitosis. Only meiosis one do we see these tetrad formation or two homologs pairing up. But one thing to point out with the crossing over, generally the way that the chromosomes will cross, will pair up. Remember, each one of these is a replicated chromosome. So there are two sister chromatids in each of these chromosomes. The way that they generally line up will allow recombination between one chromatid of each of the homologs. So this chromatid from dad and this chromatid from mom, but not these that are on the outside. Okay? We'll come back to that when we start talking about in a few lectures how to calculate the rate of recombination between points. But usually, one chromatid from each chromosome doesn't undergo recombination, one will. Okay. So then we go from metaphase, which means middle, to anaphase. Again, ana means away from. So we start moving the homologs away from each other. And that's different than what happened in mitosis. In mitosis, we pulled sister chromatids apart. In meiosis I, in anaphase, we're separating the homologs. We're pulling mom's chromosome away from dad's chromosome. Okay. But the same thing happens where they get, it's a result of the kinetochore on the chromosomes binding to the microtubule spindles and degrading them and walking towards the spindle, towards the centriole. So the mechanism's the same by which we separate them. It's just that we're separating homologs instead of sister chromatids. And so you get that kind of flying V appearance to the chromosomes. So we're separating homologs, and they're still replicated. So each one of the chromosomes still has two sister chromatids that are connected at the centromere. Then we go to telophase. Telophase, rebuild a nuclear membrane, divide the cell into two. And at this point, you have two cells. Each is 1N, or haploid.
It's one of those days. Sorry, guys.
Okay, meiosis one, you go from 2N to 1N, and you get two copies of those. We've already done the genetic reduction. When we talk about meiosis, the big things that I want you to think of, we're producing gametes for the most part, either an egg or a sperm in humans. We want to have half the genetic information that our normal cells do. So we want to go from diploid to haploid, 2N to 1N. That takes place in meiosis 1. It's just inside of each of these cells, if we were to look at each one of them, the chromosomes are all still replicated. So there's two sister chromatids for each of the chromosomes that are present in these. Okay, so then we end meiosis 1, and we go into meiosis 2. And meiosis 2 is essentially identical to what we talked about the other day in mitosis. The only thing that we're going to do in meiosis 2 is separate those sister chromatids from each other. And your book actually does something that's rare, and that is they show the second division takes place perpendicular to the first division. That's usually the way it takes place in nature, is divisions will alternate the plane on which the division takes place. So we go through prophase, where the chromosomes are condensing again. There's not another round of synthesis in here, so don't think about that. We just go from meiosis one, we divide the cells, there's a brief lag in time. Then we go into prophase two, and the chromosomes condense a little bit more to become these discrete units again. We're not replicating anything else between meiosis one, meiosis two. We already have replicated chromosomes, so we don't need to replicate anything else. And so metaphase, the centrioles have moved out. They start pushing. They make the microtubules that start extending out. They push the chromosomes into the center plate. Meta will always mean middle. Anytime you see metaphase in either process, it's when the chromosomes are in the center plane of the cell. And they line up. Then we go to, from metaphase, we go to anaphase. In anaphase, we're always going to be pulling things apart. It's just in meiosis II, like in mitosis, now we're pulling apart the sister chromatids. So we had replicated chromosomes, and now we're pulling the sister chromatids apart. The centromere divides. Each chromatid gets its own centromere after that, and they get pulled to opposite ends by that mechanism of the kinetochore interacting with the microtubule. Right, yep. Right, so meiosis one is really the special part of the process. Meiosis two just looks like mitosis. We've already done the reduction, the separation of homologs in meiosis one. So now we're separating chromatids. Then you get to telophase, and you rebuild the nuclear membranes, build up the plates between the cells, the membranes between the cells. And now we have, at the end of meiosis two, we have four one-end cells. Okay, so this is just the text of what we've gone over. Okay, so in terms of mechanism, molecular mechanisms, one of the things that when I was a student, it always bothered me, and that was in meiosis, if you're binding spindles to these things and trying to move them apart, and the same thing happens in mitosis, why is it that the sister chromatids pull apart in mitosis and meiosis two, but the sister chromatids don't just fall apart during meiosis one? That always bugged me. Okay, it didn't bug me a lot. You know, I didn't have trouble sleeping at night or anything like that. But it always seemed like an incomplete story that if they come apart that easily once the spindles start pulling, why doesn't that happen instead of pulling the homologs apart? And there's actually a molecular mechanism that's been explained in the last few years that there's a protein called cohesin. And when you have a replicated chromosome, actually when we talk about DNA replication, excuse me, in a few weeks, one of the things that happens almost immediately after DNA is replicated is cohesin will come in and loosely bind the sister chromatids together. It will keep the two copies of a chromosome together. And cohesin then just binds them together. And that way, as they're getting pushed around during metaphase, remember the spindles are binding to them and pushing them to the center, it keeps the sister chromatids together then. Okay. In mitosis and meiosis II, cohesin breaks down at that checkpoint we talked about when a kinetochore is bound by microtubule spindles. That a lot of things happen, that's the trigger for a lot of things. When a kinetochore is bound by spindles, cohesin breaks down. So then it's not holding the chromatids together and they pull apart. Okay. And even during meiosis one, some of the cohesin breaks down. Okay, so here's cohesin. It holds the microtubules together. In anaphase, when they're bound, the cohesin breaks down, and that allows the sister chromatids to get pulled apart. In meiosis one, one of the things that happens is there's a production of another protein. And this was discovered by a Japanese group, and the name of the protein is shugoshin. Okay? Shugoshin is the Japanese name. It's from a fairy tale. It basically means guardian angel in Japanese. And it's the job of shugoshin to act as the guardian angel for cohesin at a very specific moment in meiosis. So during meiosis one, shugoshin is produced. It interacts with cohesin near the centromere. Okay, only in the area surrounding the centromere. And shugoshin prevents cohesin from breaking down during anaphase of meiosis I. So the sister chromatids are anchored together by this combination of cohesin and chagosin just during anaphase of meiosis I. Chagosin is not produced during meiosis II. So during anaphase II, chagosin is not there to protect cohesin, and it breaks down, and then you can separate the sister chromatids. So when I would sit there kind of wondering what's going on, what I didn't know is it's a guardian angel protein that comes in and keeps them together during anaphase I. All right. So we've talked sort of generically about meiosis. The purpose of meiosis is to produce gametes that then can come together during fertilization. Since, as far as I know, all of you are humans in the audience, we'll focus on what's going on in humans a little bit more specifically. Because there are some differences in, while meiosis is the same, the end product is modified somewhat. And so we'll talk a little bit about spermatogenesis and oogenesis. Anytime you see two O's together in biology, it usually means egg. So egg production, sperm production. Very similar things happen in plants with pollen and egg production. But here we've got, I like the way that the little blue arrow is coming from their hinter regions of the diagram. It's like, okay, some stuff happens here. Some of the differences, though, that take place, guys, for the most part, you carry out spermatogenesis your whole life. Females, most of the eggs or many of the eggs that you produce take place before you were born. And then you just put them in the fridge and wait for them to mature when you go through puberty. So, Hugh Hefner, still pumping out new sperm, but women, for the most part, once they hit menopause, that boat has sailed. There are no eggs. The chance of the fertilization at that point is gone. Biology is not always fair and even. So what goes on with spermatogenesis? Okay, we have terms like primary spermatocytes. That's when they're getting ready to undergo meiosis. Then they go through one round of meiosis. Remember the first round of meiosis, you get two one-end cells. Those are referred to as secondary spermatocytes. They're haploid. They're one-end. Okay. Then they go through the second round of meiosis, and you get four one-end cells, roughly equal size. But the cells at that point are much larger than are needed. Okay. If you're a sperm, your job is to be quick. The selection is for good swimming sperm, okay? Because a few million of your brethren are going to be involved in a great race to the finish line, and much like Highlander, there can be only one, okay? And it, so it goes to the fastest one. So if you're a big round cell, just sort of like, oh, I hope I float and hit the egg, you're going to lose that race horribly, okay? And so sperm are modified to become streamlined. So they lose much of the volume of the cytoplasm. All of the mitochondria, which are the power plants of a cell, wind up just outside of the cell in an area called the collar. And they produce all the energy that's needed to cause the flagellum to undulate, the tail. So none of the mitochondria stay inside of the cell. I mentioned the other day you get all of your mitochondria from mom. That's because none of dad's mitochondria actually make it inside during fertilization. They all stay on the outside because that gives dad's sperm a little bit faster edge in swimming. Okay, so the job of a sperm is to swim and get there faster. There's actually a lot of really nice research that's going on now about the biology of sex. That it's not all cut and dry like we thought, that now there's evidence that depending on conditions, sometimes the female will set up hostile conditions. It's like, nope, you're not going to fertilize me. I don't want a kid right now. That there are sperm that serve as blockers. So you got sort of slower, bigger sperm that get in the way of the star halfback sperm that's going to get to the egg. But some of the interesting thing is like emotional state and how that affects the biology of fertilization. So, for example, with both genders, if the increase the likelihood of fertilization increases if you're having sex with someone that's not your usual partner, that female biologically are more receptive, their systems are more receptive to sperm from the non-usual partners. Guys tend to put out more faster sperm when they're having sex with someone that's not their usual partner. So biology rewards being promiscuous. So human ethos evolved a lot later than human biology did, so it's still a work in progress. But there's a book, I think it's called Sperm Wars or Sex Wars, sorry, one of those two things. And it's got a lot of these initial findings, and you just, at some point when you read that book, your jaw will go agape. I promise you that. At one point or another, that will happen. You just say, no, that can't be. And then you won't go out on a date for weeks to come after that. But all right. So, guys, it's pretty straightforward. You get four cells that are roughly equal size that are one end. You get rid of the extra cytoplasm. You slap a flagellum on there. You power it with all the mitochondria. Tap them on the head. Tell them to do their best Michael Phelps and Godspeed to them. With women, it's a different thing. Eggs are going to be the initial environment in which an embryo develops. And so eggs don't want to be small. They don't want to be streamlined. Eggs want to be the most nurturing environment that they can be. So what happens in oogenesis is there's unequal division. When we get to telophase and we do the actual cytokinesis, you don't produce two equal cells. Even though the genetic division of meiosis has been equal, the cytoplasm's divided unequally. So what happens, you've got the primary oocytes, you undergo the first round of meiosis, and you get one really big cell and one smaller cell. And the bigger cell is the one that will go on into meiosis II. It's referred to as a secondary oocyte. Okay? The smaller first one, it's not big enough to do anything. So it just sort of hangs around at one end. It's referred to as a polar body. It gets taken out of consideration to become an egg at this point. Right? It's Danny DeVito in Twins, if you've ever seen that movie. It was the small vestigial afterthought of a process to produce something wonderful. That's what happens. The polar body gets no love after that point. The secondary oocyte then goes through the second round of meiosis, but again, it produces a second polar body. And so at the end of oogenesis, you get one egg that's one end, and as opposed to spermatogenesis where you get four sperm cells. Okay? So it seems kind of like a wasteful product, but remember, women really, in humans, women only have to produce one egg for each menstrual cycle. Sometimes they release more than one egg, but basically if you've got a woman that's got a 30-year span of being fertile, so she's got to do 360 eggs, as opposed to guys produce millions of sperm each day. So you can be less efficient to come up with an egg that is a little bit more robust. But that uneven division, again, in the oocytes, they're getting more mitochondria. They're getting more of the cell organelles that will allow them to, once fertilized, to rapidly expand and carry out mitosis at that point. We won't go too much into plants. But then with fertilization, we'll talk about fertilization briefly now, but for the most part, we'll talk about it when we really start hitting on genetic variation. But you've got sperm. Each of these four sperm will contain different DNA as a result of which homologue went where, how recombination took place. So even with just four sperm, we've got variation as to which one fertilizes the egg. Each egg that a woman produces is genetically unique. Even though she may only produce one egg during a menstrual cycle, that egg from all of her genetic material is a unique egg. And so that the amount of genetic variation that takes place in humans just from this process of producing four sperm and one egg from two rounds of meiosis, even before you factor in recombination, it's huge. You make sure that essentially no two offsprings, other than if you have identical twins, which is an unusual situation, you don't look exactly like your siblings. It's because of the genetic variation that takes place through meiosis and then random fertilization. Which one of these sperms is going to get there first and fertilize the egg that was released in that menstrual cycle for the female? Let's see. All right, so I was a little bit behind the other day, so we'll hit Mendel and see if we get close to caught up. I warned you the other day, my PhD is in genetics. I respect what Gregor Mendel did, but for the most part, I'm going to tell you to get over Mendel, that you've been inundated with Mendel in junior high and high school and 197 if you had Dr. Katz. So we will tip our hat to Mendel today. We'll talk briefly about what he studied, and then we'll talk about why it's really limited to think in terms of genetics the way that Mendel thought about genetics. But was he a bright guy? Yes. Did he make, fundamental discoveries? Yep. But time to move on. So what did Mendel do? I mean, he developed a lot of the genetic terminology. He basically came up with the field of genetics, but he put his work out there, and it just sort of fell flat, and it was a couple decades after he put his work out that people thought, oh, wait, maybe this is consistent with some other things that we're seeing now. The other thing that I will warn you about is I really don't like standing up here before class. I get a little self-conscious. So in the future, when you guys come into class, assuming I'm not running late, there will be really obnoxious or bizarre videos, music videos of the 80s and 90s playing in here for about the last 4 or 5 minutes before class. So I'll try to not make any of them offensive, but there were things that were on TV in the 80s and 90s that we never thought were offensive that now are fairly offensive when you look back at them. So one of them I want to put on is one from The Art of Noise, and it's just bunch of musicians walking around destroying instruments, but there's this little bizarre-looking girl, but she's got makeup caked all over her, and she just really moves in a weird fashion. It's a weird video. People never forget it once they see it. And I'm just thinking, okay, I ought to do that. And then I said, Penn State, I can't be putting kids all tarted up on videos in front of class and stuff. So maybe later in the semester, after you guys get to know me and you realize that's really not my thing, so hopefully you get to know me and you realize Nichols isn't about tarted up 6-year-olds. So. All right. So some of the terminology we're going to go through. A gene. Okay? And you can have entire classes in which there is an argument about what is a gene. And it really depends on the level at which you approach the question. I have a colleague, Chris Horvath, who's also joint appointment with philosophy, and he loves to get into this discussion. I stay out of that discussion because I have a very discreet definition of a gene, and that is, but I was trained as a molecular geneticist. In Mendel's world, a gene was something that produced a trait. Okay? It was some particle in the biology that resulted in the manifestation of a trait. So in pea plants, a gene was responsible for the color of the flower or the color of the pea or the shape of the pea. In this class, when I talk about a gene, I am talking about a discrete fragment of DNA that produces an RNA molecule, that many of which result in the expression of a trait. But a gene is a fragment of DNA that is expressed biologically. Okay? And we'll talk about that process throughout the semester, how the genes are expressed, how they're regulated, how they're controlled. Okay? An allele is if there's more than one version of a gene. So if you've got, in Mendel's world, we'll talk about the flower color on his plants. If you've got one for purple and one for white, that means you've got two alleles for that same gene. Okay? It's the gene that's responsible for the trait flower color. That gene is present at a specific place on the DNA, but there are two versions of that gene. And as I warned you the other day, we'll talk a little bit about dog coat color. In some cases, you can have five or six alleles for a certain gene. Okay? A locus is the specific place on a chromosome on which a gene occurs. Locus just means location. Right? Plural of that are loci. But the locus just means if we're looking at the chromosome. Okay, wow, a lot of bad markers up here today. If we're looking at the chromosome, physically on the chromosome, so here's a telomere, here's the telomere, here's the centromere in the middle. That's the place where the gene occurs. So this would be the locus. Okay. The gene is responsible for the trait itself. And if there are two different versions of that, okay, then this would be one allele, and this would be the second allele. Okay. Locus is just physically where it is on the chromosome. So if you are scanning the chromosome looking for a gene, you are narrowing down the locus. You know what the gene is. It encodes a trait, but you're trying to find its street address. Okay? Genotype. Genotype just means the combination of alleles that an individual possesses. Okay? We're going to be talking about in Mendelian or transmission genetics, we'll be talking about situations in which a person or an organism will have two copies, will have two chromosomes, so they will have two copies of the same genes. If you've got two copies of the same gene, that means either you can have two copies of the same allele or you can have two different alleles. That's the genotype. Are they the same or are they different for that gene? Okay? So that's what we mean by the genotype. What's the actual combination of alleles that the individual has. All right, so the combinations that you can have then for the genotypes are homozygous, or homozygous. An individual that's homozygous is referred to as a homozygote. Okay, and that means the two alleles are the same. So in biology, when you see homo, that means same or identical. And the other possibility are heterozygous. Or an individual that is heterozygous are referred to as heterozygotes. And this means that the two alleles are different. And hetero in biology means other or different. Okay. So it's pretty much it. For genotype, for each gene, the individual will either be a homozygous or heterozygous with respect to those alleles. All right. This is where it gets tricky. Phenotype. In Mendel's world, and these are the genotypes. Let me get rid of the myocytes over here. Okay. Genotype means we're looking at the actual genetics, the actual genes and alleles involved. Phenotype, in Mendel's world, that meant what's it look like? How is the trait manifested? What can I observe that's different about this organism? Okay. So with respect to the same gene that we would talk about with this genotype, how is the trait that's encoded by that gene, how is it manifested? So we've been using Mendel's flowers that are either purple and white. If we're looking at that genotype, do they have two copies of the purple allele, two copies of the white allele, one copy of each? And if so, what color is the flower? Is it purple or white? Okay. Said it was easy in Mendel's world because everything that he did was just based on visual observation of relatively large characteristics of the plants. But now we've got molecular tools. We can dissect organisms down to a molecular level that what a phenotype is gets a lot more gray these days. You know, we can do a biochemical assay to determine that, oh, the phenotype is there's 10% less enzymatic activity in that cell. It's not something that you could just look at it and tell that from the outside. So as our tools become more and more specific to look at smaller changes in organisms, phenotypes become more and more specific as well. But when we talk about Mendel, like seven big characteristics of the plant is what we'll focus on. We'll move on. Okay, and this is just showing the idea. This was up the other day with alleles. Again, the alleles will be for a gene, and the genes, unless there's been some sort of bad recombination event, the genes will be present at the same locus on the chromosomes. So in both of your homologs that you have in your cells, the gene for each trait that you have should be present on the same chromosome at the same location. All right. Let's look at what Mendel did. Let's see. So Mendel was a monk. He had a lot of free time in the monastery. He kept gardens. Mendel worked with pea plants. And so the original work for the field of genetics was based off of pea plants. And he found seven traits that he described. Scientific historians have gone back and looked at Mendel's work. It's really tough to replicate Mendel's work and have results that are as clean as he had. So he may have tweaked them ever so slightly, or just conditions were right and he got really nice data that gave him the ratios in a very clean fashion. But one of the things that Mendel looked at is the shape of the peas. They could either be smooth and round or they could be wrinkly. And Mendel, after he saw these, looked at these traits, that what he came up with, the idea that he had, was that each individual is has two copies of a gene. Okay. Mendel did not know about DNA. DNA was not really discovered and certainly wasn't characterized until the 1940s. Mendel had no idea about DNA. Mendel didn't even know about chromosomes. Okay. Mendel just thought there's something inside of individuals that they've got two copies of them, and when they carry out fertilization, that the egg or the sperm, or in the case of plants, the pollen or the ovum, were had half the genetic information of each parent. And during fertilization, they were combined and you could get new combinations. So what Mendel did was he bred the plants until he had true breeding lines. What that meant was he had one line of plants where as long as he kept breeding those plants with each other, the peas would always be round. He had another line of plants that as long as he kept breeding them with each other, the peas would always be wrinkled. Those are called true breeding lines in Mendel's world. And you also hear that phrase, and if you're an ag major, we still tend to refer to breeding lines. Genetically, what we're really talking about with true breeding lines is their homozygous for a trait. They will never express the other trait because they only have one of the two versions of the allele. That everyone in that true breeding line for the round seeds has the round allele. All of them in the wrinkled ones has the wrinkled allele. Okay? And so they will always produce offspring that looks exactly like themselves as long as they're bred with the same line. So Mendel established a lot of these true breeding lines. He got these lines of homozygotes. And then he starts saying, okay, what happens now when I cross them? I don't allow them to breed within the line. I cross the lines. And so you breed a plant that's got the smooth round seeds with one that's got the wrinkled seeds. At that point, you're taking one allele from this one allele from that one. They're combined in fertilization. Okay? That was one of Mendel's big ideas, is that you get one allele from each parent and they're combined in fertilization. Prior to this point in time, the most popular idea was that you were basically filled with small particles that had essence of humanness, and some was contained in the egg, some was contained in the sperm, and they just mixed. But the idea of a specific biological mechanism that would explain this, that there's a gene basically means particle, that combined. Beforehand, it was just sort of like, oh, mom's got pink paint, dad's got blue paint, and when they combine, you get a kid that has some features of dad, some features of mom, but really doesn't look that much like either one. It was believed to be a blending event. With Mendel, the idea of a gene, it's a particulate. You get some particles from mom, some particles from dad, but it's not a true blending event. Okay, then you undergo fertilization. Then what Mendel saw in the first generation of a cross, it's referred to as the F1 generation. I refer to my kids as the F1s if I'm talking to somebody at work. It's much easier than referring to them by name. So I just say, I got to go pick up the F1s. They understand what I'm talking about. And later I hang my head in shame realizing, oh my God, I've become a loser of science. I never wanted to go down that road, but I have. And my kids don't have a chance either. Their mother has a PhD in microbiology, so I'm really hoping they both become artists and cool people and sort of rebel against logic and terminology. Okay, so the F1 generation then is what happens when you cross these two true breeding lines. You get one allele from round, one from wrinkled, and what Mendel saw was they were all round. Every one of the offspring had round seeds. So I thought, okay, I've got one of the parents has round, but the other parent always has wrinkled. And it didn't matter which parent was which, whether mom was wrinkled or dad was wrinkled. All of the offspring were round. And so Mendel then came up with another set of terminology. When that happens, when you've got two traits that are available, or two expressions of the same trait, in one, so he knew, well, he postulated, if they were true breeding lines and they were both homozygotes, that the F1 generation had to be a heterozygote. It had to have the round allele from one parent and the wrinkled allele from the other parent. And so, in this case, the round is capital R, the wrinkled is small r. So when you've got two traits, or two expressions of a trait, or versions of a trait, okay, the one that is expressed in the heterozygote is called the dominant trait. It's dominant because when you've got one of each, round in this case is expressed There's no sign of wrinkled being expressed at all. You know, this thing wasn't part round, part wrinkled. It looked exactly like the peas produced by the true breeding line of round. Okay. So then the one that's not expressed, in the heterozygote, is called recessive. Okay. So in this situation, round is dominant, wrinkled is recessive for P shape. Okay. Then he went a step further. So he thought, okay, each one's got a dominant, each one's got a recessive. He went a step further then, and he took the F1s. All of these F1s that all looked round, they all had round P shape, and he started crossing them. Okay. And then he got the F2 generation, okay, the second fertilization from the true breeding lines by crossing the true breeding lines. Okay. And in the F2 generations, he saw both traits expressed. Okay. So how the trait was expressed is the phenotype. Okay. So whether it was round or wrinkled is the phenotype. Which alleles they have are the genotype. And so what he saw was, for the phenotype, 3/4 of the F2s had round peas, 1/4 had wrinkled peas. But when he went through and tried to determine what the genotypes would be, predict what the genotypes would be, 1/4 would be homozygous dominant, that they would have 2 alleles for round. 1/4 would be homozygous for recessive. The only time that you'll see the recessive phenotype is in a homozygote for the recessive alleles. If there's a dominant allele present, they won't express the recessive phenotype. The only time you could get wrinkled would be if you have 2 alleles, for 2 wrinkled alleles. If there's a round allele present, it's going to be round. And half of them were heterozygotes. They had 1 copy of round, 1 copy of wrinkled. The 1/4 that were homozygous dominant and the 50% or half that were heterozygotes, that makes up 3/4. That's how you get the 3/4 being round. The dominant phenotype will comprise homozygous dominant and heterozygotes. You add those two together and you should get the phenotype frequency. Right? And we don't need to get into the F3s right now. Okay. So Mendel did that for multiple traits, and they all panned out the same. That with the F1s all looked like one parent. He decided or determined then which allele was dominant. The F2, he always got a 3-to-1 phenotypic ratio. Okay, 3-to-1 phenotypic ratio. So how did they look with 3 being the dominant and 1 being the recessive phenotype? For all of the 7 traits that he described. So then we get one of Mendel's laws. His first law is of the idea of segregation. And that is, each organism is a diploid. You've got 2 alleles for any one trait. And when gametes are produced, those alleles are separated. Okay. This was probably Mendel's biggest contribution. That idea that traits are encoded by 2 alleles, and when gametes are produced, you only get 1 of them. Remember, he had no idea about chromosomes. After an hour and a half in here of genetics lecture, you know more about genetics than Mendel did. You know about meiosis and mitosis and how chromosomes are separated biologically. He didn't have that background to work with. He was just, okay, there's got to be something out there, and they're separated. And when chromosomes were discovered later, that was when people had the aha moment. It was, wow, these chromosomes behave just like that Mendel guy was describing. Okay? So you've got two copies of alleles that encode a trait. During gamete production, only one copy of that goes into each gamete. And then during fertilization, you get one copy of the allele from mom, one copy of the allele from dad, and the combination of the alleles determines how that trait is expressed. And then he came up with the idea of dominance and recessive. We've talked about that. The dominant will be expressed in a heterozygote. The recessive won't. And again, this ties in with what we talked about with meiosis, the separation of the homologs, mom's chromosome going one way, dad's chromosome going the other. All right. Okay. The other shameful admission that I will make to you guys today is, in large part, I signed up for a PhD program in genetics because I was the one kid in the class that loved doing Punnett squares. When I was in junior high and high school, I loved logic problems, any sort of, math-based or logic-based puzzle. I love those things. Punnett squares were in my wheelhouse. You're gonna do a few. I'm not gonna have you guys do Punnett squares into the ground. I want you to use them enough to know how things are playing out. But as I've been talking about, Mendel, he looked at big traits that have two different versions. Much of what makes you you aren't those types of traits. We don't have tall humans and short humans. Right? It's not a dominant one gene that you're either 6'3" or you're 5'3". It doesn't work that way. Skin color doesn't work that way. Eye color doesn't work that way. There are very few really important traits in humans that are gross manifestations of one of two expressions that are dominant or recessive. So we're going to spend most of our time talking about those subtleties as opposed to what color flower a pea plant has, but how you can look and predict how alleles will move through generations is you can do that through Punnett squares. If you had Dr. Katz, he's a math person, so he just looks at things. He's like, oh, this is 12.5%. We'll cheat and teach you how to do that a little bit too, but we will do some Punnett squares. And so here's just an example. There'll be homework assigned on Thursday. It's not due Thursday. There'll be homework assigned Thursday, so you've got the whole weekend to do it. And there'll be a couple of Punnett squares, really basic ones for you to do there just to shake the rust off. Again, I assume you guys have all had 197. This is just a reminder more than it's we're going to cover the same stuff in the same detail. Okay. So what you do with the Punnett square, when you're looking at a single trait, you just draw a 2x2 box. And here we've got, in Mendel's world, height of a pea plant is actually a strict dominant recessive relationship. Plants are either tall or they're short. And there's not a continuum of height in between with pea plants. So he had tall plants, or tall was dominant over short. And so in this case, he's got a heterozygote. So the heterozygote, if tall is dominant, the heterozygote would have a tall phenotype. And so, but its genotype, since it's a heterozygote, is it has a dominant and a recessive allele. We always write the dominant in capital, and then the recessive is the same letter in small case. So big T, little t is tall is dominant, short is recessive. And then he crosses that with a short plant. It's got a short phenotype. That means it has to be homozygous for short. So little t, little t. And then you just combine them. So this big T goes into each of these. This little t comes into each of these two boxes, and then you do the columns, then you do the rows. And you look at what you get. Okay? So this tells you if they had four offspring. Pea plants typically have more than four offspring, but there are four different combinations of alleles that can play out here. So we've got two that are heterozygotes and two that are homozygous recessive. Okay? So the genotypes, these are the genotypes, right? We're actually talking about the combination of the alleles. The genotypic ratio is 1:1 for heterozygotes to homozygous recessive. The phenotypic ratio is also 1:1, dominant to recessive. Half, these will exhibit the dominant phenotype. These will exhibit the recessive phenotype. Okay. Now, if he had, instead of the heterozygote, if he had his true breeding lines, like we talked about earlier, right? So if you had homozygous dominant times homozygous recessive, this would be like his initial cross that produced the F1s. Okay? You do the columns, then you do the rows. Okay? Every one of them is a heterozygote. And the heterozygotes will always look like the dominant. So when he did this experiment, instead of using the P shape, when he did this experiment, did the true breeding lines cross them, 100% of the offspring would have been tall. 100% were heterozygotes, and tall then was the dominant trait. Okay? So when you do Punnett squares, take the genotype of the parent, divide it into two columns, take the genotype of the other parent, divide it into two rows, do your square, drop the columns down, take the rows across, and then look at the combination that you get, the ratios, the numbers of each. Okay? So we'll have a few of those for you on Thursday, and then we'll start doing multiple traits. This is just a single trait at a time. That's what I told you. Okay. So the problem with individuals that express the dominant phenotype, okay, is you don't know if they're a homozygote or if they're a heterozygote, if they exhibit the dominant phenotype. What these rules tell you is 3/4 of the F2s were going to be dominant phenotype, 1/4 would be homozygous dominant, 1/2 would be heterozygotes. But looking at them, you can't tell which one is which. The phenotype doesn't allow you to distinguish between those two genotypes, homozygous dominant and heterozygous. So Mendel had to come up with a way to test whether an individual that had the dominant phenotype was a homozygote or a heterozygote. And what he came up with was the cross that we just had up here a couple minutes ago, in which you cross the dominant with the recessive phenotype, an organism with a recessive phenotype. So remember the first one that we had, okay, this would be a heterozygote, this was the homozygous dominant. If the organism that's expressing the dominant phenotype is a heterozygote, in the offspring, when you cross them with a homozygous individual, a homozygous recessive, you'll get a 1:1 ratio of dominant to recessive. If they're a homozygote for the dominant allele, all of the offspring will be dominant. And so you take an individual that's got a dominant phenotype, you cross them with an individual that's got a recessive phenotype, and you look at the offspring. It would either be 50-50 or it will be all of them dominant. And that's referred to as a test cross. When you take an a dominant phenotype individual of unknown genotype, cross them with the recessive. Now we know if we see this 50-50 breakdown of dominant and recessive, we know that this parent was a heterozygote. And then that allowed him to go back and test whether those percentages were correct. And the 25% homozygous, 50% heterozygous genotype predictions were accurate. Okay. Now we're going to start getting a little bit into some of the problems with Mendel and some of the conditions in which Mendelian or transmission genetics doesn't work perfectly. And some of them, what we're learning here can still apply. So these are just slight headaches in Mendel's world. And the first one is incomplete dominance. And incomplete dominance just means that when you get a heterozygote, instead of the heterozygote looking like the dominant phenotype, the heterozygote will actually be halfway between dominant and recessive. Okay. So one of the classic examples is with a plant called a 4 o'clock plant. Its flower colors, red and white. The heterozygotes are pink. Your book likes eggplant. I'm actually allergic to eggplant, so I don't really like seeing them up there much. If my throat swells and I fall to the ground, you guys can take the rest of the day off. You're like, please, dear God, I'm going to bring him Baba Ganoush next week. Okay, so eggplant color is incomplete dominant. The dark purple color that you see is dominant, that there are some white eggplants. If you cross those, then you get sort of a lighter shade of purple that's present. Those are heterozygotes. So if you cross two plants that have the light purple color, then you'll get 25% will have the dark color, 25% will have white, and half of them will be light in color, the light purple. So the genotypes play out exactly the same. If you do the Punnett squares, the ratios of the genotypes play out exactly the same. It's just you don't get that clean 3-to-1 phenotypic ratio anymore because heterozygotes have their own phenotype. So now you get a 1-to-2-to-1 phenotypic ratio, okay, which is the same as the 1-to-2-to-1 genotypic ratio. Okay, one homozygous dominant, one heterozygous dominant, sorry, one homozygous dominant, one homozygous recessive, two heterozygous is the 1-to-2-to-1. Okay. When you've got incomplete dominance, the phenotypic ratio and the genotypic ratio are exactly the same because there's no true dominance or recessive phenotypes. You've got this intermediate one for incomplete dominance. Okay. And there are actually quite a few traits that play out as incomplete dominant traits. Oh, just a larger picture. All right. I actually think this is probably worth your time to become familiar with. These are just genotypic or phenotypic ratios for different genetic crosses. If you just get used to where you've just got these down pat, you know that if you've got a cross between two heterozygotes, that you're going to have a 3-to-1 phenotypic ratio. Life moves much faster for you. Like, it's generally a good thing in here. So I need you guys to, I would suggest that you guys just take a few minutes and go over this table so that you're comfortable with it. And then when it just says uniform progeny, it just means all of the offspring will be exactly the same. I need you guys to quiet down a little bit. I can hear you up here. Okay. So Mendel did a lot of work doing that, looking at one trait at a time, doing those crosses, calculating what the ratios were, making predictions, and coming up with his first law then about the traits segregating, and then you get one allele from each parent during fertilization. And then he got really ballsy and decided, okay, I'm going to look at two traits at one time. I'm not going to focus just on smooth or wrinkled or tall and short. I'm going to go all crazy and I'm going to look at tall and smooth and short and wrinkled. Okay? And so he started working on multiple traits. This is where people that look back at Mendel's work think that he either got really lucky or there's a lot of the story that he decided not to really tell us and he just took the cleanest results, because out of all the traits in a pea plant, he looked at seven, and the one thing that they have in common is all seven of them are independent of each other, and they will do what he's going to tell us that they did again. This is all based on alleles being on different chromosomes. If he would have looked at traits that had genes on the same chromosome, none of this would have panned out the way that he's telling us. So either Mendel really lucky and, you know, God shined down upon him for being a good monk and keeping a good garden, or he cooked his books and then just cherry-picked his data and told us what he wanted to. All right, so when you're looking at one trait, that's referred to as a monohybrid cross. Okay, so those first crosses he did are monohybrid crosses. A hybrid is basically a heterozygote. When he started looking at two traits, that's called a dihybrid cross. Two traits at one time. So let's see if I got a better picture. Okay, so what he did with this one, some of the traits are the color of the peas as well. You don't see yellow peas very often in grocery stores, but in fact, pea plants can produce yellow peas. And yellow is actually the dominant color. That all of the plants that produce green peas that are out there are homozygous recessive for green. It's just, I don't know if it's more appealing or it just keeps you from confusing it with corn or what's going on, but we like green peas better. So we worked with round yellow peas. Both of those are dominant. And then he's got green wrinkly peas. Cross those. Those are the true breeding lines. Right? So they're homozygous for each of the traits. That as long as he crossed these round yellow with round yellow, they would always produce round yellow. When he produced the or crossed the green wrinkly with green wrinklies, they would always produce green wrinklies. Then he just had that day when he went all hell cut loose and I'm just going to cross the round yellows with the green wrinklies today. And he did that, and all of them were round and yellow. So just like the monohybrid cross, where when you cross them, you get all dominants in the first generation. So 100% of the F1s were dominant for each of the two traits. His predicted genotypes, that they were heterozygous for each of the traits. They had a dominant and a recessive allele for each of the two traits. Okay. Then he crossed the F1s, and instead of getting a 3-to-1 ratio, he got all kinds of different combinations. Okay, so what he saw is a 9-to-3 to 3-to-1 ratio. Okay, this is in the dihybrid. Remember, in the monohybrid, you saw a 3-to-1 phenotypic ratio. Okay. So what he saw, the 9 would be round and yellow. The 3 would be round and green. Okay. These 3 would be yellow and, let's go wrinkly and yellow. And these would be wrinkly and green. Okay, so both dominant. Down here is both recessive. And this is one dominant, one recessive, and this one is the opposite. Okay, so 9:3 to 3:1 ratio with these. Okay, if you're comfortable with math at all, okay, if you take a 3:1 ratio and you multiply that times a 3:1 ratio, okay, to multiply ratios, all you do is you multiply this times 3, then you multiply this whole thing times 1. So you would get 3 times 3 is 9. 3 times 1 is 1, or is 3. Sorry, math was never my good thing. Then 1 times 3 is 3. 1 times 1 is 1. So if you take two separate events that have a 3:1 ratio and multiply those together, you get a 9:3 to 3:1. So when, in statistics, when you multiply two things together, that means the events are independent. Right? You need both of those events to take place independent of each other. So what these ratios told Mendel is, what he really saw was, if he just went back and looked at the ratio for round and wrinkly, that was 3:1. If he looked at the ratio of yellow to green, that was 3:1. But when he looked at these combinations, it was 9:3 to 3:1. So the alleles moved independently for color and shape. And that this ratio explains that these two events happen separate of each other. That if you got the round allele, that didn't affect what color you were going to be. That they were completely separate events. Okay, so that's when Mendel came up with his second law. Let me see if we've got a box for it. Nope. Okay, it's the law of independent assortment. Okay. And what independent assortment means is the alleles of one trait will not affect the alleles of the other, how they're inherited, how they're separated during gamete production, and then how they come together during fertilization. That color of the pea didn't affect shape of the pea, that those alleles were separate. Right? It explained what he saw, but the situation that we'll get into is that's not true if the two alleles are on the same chromosome. And that's why I said Mendel did these seven traits, all of them assorted independently. He didn't have two traits that were encoded on the same chromosome. Once they start traveling on the same chromosome, they don't separate. At that point, if you've got a dominant allele for round with a dominant allele for color, as long as that chromosome doesn't undergo recombination, those two are physically linked to each other. So Mendel's rule of independent assortment works for traits that have loci on different chromosomes. And you will hate the fact that much of biology takes place in combinations of alleles that are present on the same chromosome, and we'll calculate recombination frequencies in a few days. So we'll stop there. Thanks for your patience.